Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Migrants working away from their families made significant sacrifices to send almost as much money home last year as they did before COVID, UN Chief Antonio Guterres said on Wednesday, warning that now is not the time for countries to withdraw their support to these key workers. The Secretary-General's message to mark the International Day of Family Remittances comes as World Bank data showed that cash wired home from migrants in wealthy countries dropped only 1.6% in 2020 from 12 months earlier to $540 billion. Migrants put their families first by buying less and dipping into their savings to send money to relatives, Mr. Guterres said. Financial support from host countries also played its part, and it must continue, he insisted, urging all countries to include migrant workers in their COVID-19 vaccination plans. They should also aim to reduce the costs of sending remittances to as close to zero as possible, in line with the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, he said. To the Democratic Republic of the Congo now, where the UN on Wednesday condemned a spike in hate speech that looked to incite ethnic division in several parts of the country. Bintou Keita, who represents the UN Secretary-General in DR Congo, urged all political and community leaders to abstain from using discriminatory and provocative language at a time of exceptional instability in eastern provinces. She said that hate speech was prevalent in the Kivus and Ituri, but also in Katanga, Mai-Ndombe, and even in the capital, Kinshasa. Incitement to hate, violence, and conflict runs contrary to international and Congolese law, Ms. Keita noted, before urging the country's parliament to adopt a proposed bill against tribalism, racism, and xenophobia. Finally, an appeal on Wednesday from the UN Secretary-General to protect land from erosion and unsustainable development and help vulnerable communities adapt to climate change. In his message marking the World Day to combat desertification and drought, Antonio Guterres said that land degradation from climate change and the expansion of agriculture, cities and infrastructure have undermined the well-being of 3.2 billion people. In addition to the harm done to the planet's biodiversity, the UN chief insisted that land degradation had also allowed infectious diseases to emerge, such as COVID-19. To counter this, greater efforts are needed to promote healthy land, he said. The benefits include removing carbon from the atmosphere and the generation of an extra $1.4 trillion in agricultural production each year. The best part is that land restoration is simple, inexpensive, and accessible to all, according to the UN Secretary General, who said that it was one of the best ways of accelerating progress towards the Sustainable Development Goals. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Ron Kuby joins us with an update on Stephen Donziger's trial.
Ron Kuby's a great trial lawyer. So is his co-counsel, Marty Garbus. They really put up a great fight. Check out the details.
Julian Assange's father, John Shipton, joins us with an update on his son's case.
John Shipton has been touring the United States trying to save the life of his son, Julian Assange.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. 3 weeks ago, environmental attorney Stephen Donziger's Chevron-funded trial for misdemeanor contempt drew to a close. Stephen and his defense team are now waiting for what they claim is an inevitable verdict of guilty by Chevron-linked Judge Loretta Preska. As Stephen has written to his supporters, Preska denied him a jury of unbiased fact-finders by ordering a bench trial. She also ruled against Stephen and his attorneys on 99% of all their courtroom objections. Stephen notes that Preska, a conservative judge and a former member of the Federalist Society's advisory board, was actually reading the newspaper during witness testimony. The defense team is now preparing for its expected appeal after Preska delivers her ruling. They're following up on and researching additional revelations of corruption by Chevron and the high-paid lawyers challenging the original multi-billion dollar fines for Chevron's toxic pollution in Ecuador. Joining us today for an update on these preparations is attorney Ron Kuby, who, along with law partner Rhea Trivedi and noted First Amendment attorney Martin Garbus, comprise the Donziger defense team. Ron is the former associate of William Kunstler, and his body of work continues to uphold their tradition of representing the poor, the downtrodden, and the wrongfully accused. Ron, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Why, thank you so much, Heidi. Thank you, Michael.
Ron, during Stephen's recent trial, information surfaced that may be useful on appeal. The defense obtained records from Chevron CEO Mike Wirth. What did those reveal?
We had obtained a series of records going back to 2009. One of them was a record from a public relations firm that was plugged into the highest echelons of Chevron Corporation, which specifically stated, our long-term strategy is to demonize Donziger. Then, following up on a lead that was published in all places in the Wall Street Journal, we were able to obtain documents from 2010 showing that lead lawyers for Chevron met with federal prosecutors, this of course would be in the Obama administration, trying to get Stephen Donziger prosecuted criminally by the federal government. Those efforts failed completely. The federal prosecutors wanted nothing to do with the case. We also obtained documents from Chevron which indicated they had an extensive public relations and private pressure strategy against all supporters of Donziger personally, supporters of the Ecuador litigation, and people who supported the non-destruction of the rainforest generally, an extremely sophisticated, well-funded campaign to put pressure, again, on donors to dry up funds to progressive organizations, environmental organizations.
Ron, one of Chevron's lawyers, millionaire William Thompson, admitted in court that Chevron had been flying him first class from L.A. to New York to help private prosecutors convict Stephen, and he bills at an astonishing $1,300 an hour for his services. What relevance does this have?
Well, the case was presented through Chevron lawyers from Gibson Dunn Crutcher, and William Thompson testified at great length. And one of the things he and this was kind of hilariously funny, because what Chevron and Gibson Dunn Crutcher, their law firm, had done was to try to separate Chevron from this criminal prosecution. So all of the lawyers decided, no doubt out of generosity, to donate all of their time to help get the private special prosecutor up to date. They donated hundreds and hundreds of hours worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, and specifically testified that Chevron was not being billed for any of it. They were simply there in order to discharge their obligations as citizens to comply with a subpoena. Well, on cross-examination, we pointed out that, yeah, you had to show up here, but you didn't have to spend hundreds of hours helping the special prosecutor prepare the case. You know, when you get a subpoena, you have to show up, but you don't have to do prep work. And then they explained that this was just trying to be good citizenship or to be prepared to, you know, and all of these sort of ridiculous explanations. And I asked them on cross-examination, do you give to charity? And they said, yes, of course. And is Chevron one of your favorite charities? So it was all this ridiculously transparent attempt to, you know, to reenacting, you know, Godfather II when, you know, there's testimony before the House subcommittee to create a buffer between Chevron and the law firm and the special prosecutors. What became hilariously funny, though, was that, in fact, by mistake, Gibson Dunn Crutcher actually did bill Chevron for one of the round-trip first-class plane tickets that flew millionaire lawyer Thompson into New York City. They didn't discover that till after Thompson testified, and then there's this, like, really, really funny last-minute, late Saturday night attempt attempt to clean up the record and say we properly credited Chevron with the tickets that we improperly billed them for. It was all just, you know, this ridiculous and in many ways tragic demonstration of the relationship between big law and big oil.
Ron, the trial transcripts show that Chevron paid its attorneys as much as $10 million to help private prosecutor Rita Glavin target Stephen. That's despite her claims of independence. Talk about Glavin and her sense of ethics, please.
You know, I'm not quite sure where the $10 million figure comes from, as far as that goes, because the private prosecutors work very, very closely with Chevron lawyers, but Chevron lawyers didn't bill Chevron because they wanted to maintain this illusion of independence. For out of kindness, I suppose, they donated, you know, all of these hundreds of thousands of dollars, even millions of dollars worth of time. Now, it was clear from the transcripts that Chevron was billed $3.1 million by its legal team to help recover $813,000 from Donziger. Now, you only have to think about that for a moment to realize that nobody spends $3 million to get $800,000. And so the money for Chevron was never the issue. The issue was always demonizing, destroying, and marginalizing Donziger. I mean, unfortunately, or fortunately perhaps, like all bullies, Chevron didn't know how to take the win. They didn't know when to quit. Like, okay, we won this case, which they did back in 2017. It was unfair. It was wrong. There was no jury, but they won. It was affirmed. And they could have just walked away. But they decided to go after Donziger, to utterly destroy him. You know, as an object lesson, I guess, to other lawyers who dare take on these kinds of clients. But in the process of trying to destroy him financially, in term blizzard of papers, documents, litigation, you know, they people started to take notice that this, like, one guy now working out of his kitchen pro se is facing this ferocious attack by Chevron and being held in contempt by Judge Kaplan, a corporatist judge who spent his earlier career representing big tobacco. People started to notice. Then more people started to notice. And then people started to protest. And Chevron, in its you know, bullying, overreaching, in its arrogance, you know, really created a movement in opposition to them. Whereas, you know, prudence would have dictated they simply walk away a few years ago, but that's just not their style.
The trial transcripts also show that Judge Preska ruled against Stephen's defense attorneys 99% of the time when they objected in court. What does this mean? And have you ever seen a high percentage like that? Does this suggest judicial bias?
I'm thinking it was me, Michael. I'm just thinking I was being objectionable. You know, it's happened. But what was actually going on was, I mean, the reason Judge Preska, you know, ruled against this so many times was she made the decision, which was not legally required, but she made the decision that she was not going to allow us to attack the validity of the underlying order that gave rise to the civil contempt, to the criminal contempts, rather. It's really wonky. Lawyers know it as the collateral bar rule, but basically it says, if you're held in criminal contempt for violating a court order, it is a given that the order is valid. You're not allowed to challenge it. So the only questions are, did you know about the order? Did you comply or violate the order? And did you do so knowingly? And the basis of half of our defense, at least, was that Donziger objected to the underlying orders, believed reasonably that he was entitled to do the things that he was doing, and ultimately the Second Circuit ruled that his belief was a completely reasonable belief based upon what the district court had ruled. In other words, the Second Circuit ruled that Stephen was acting in good faith when he was doing the things that Chevron objected to and that Judge Kaplan held him in civil contempt for, then held him in criminal contempt for. But the judge refused to allow us to address that at all. So the only thing defense counsel could do at trial, since our defense was precluded, at least as to half of the case, was to impeach the credibility of the witnesses who testified. You know, which we did as best we can, pointing out their financial interests, you know, and other matters related to Chevron. And even then, most of the time, they asserted attorney-client privilege, often asserting it improperly and incorrectly. And Judge Preska just went ahead and ruled against us on all of those claims. So there's no universe in which Judge Preska can be considered a fair and impartial judge. And we have to remember the way she was selected. And in case we don't remember, I'll recite it. Judge Kaplan had presided over the Donziger-Chevron litigation since 2010, even though the case never should have gone to him originally. Judge Kaplan was the one who agreed that Chevron could waive its right to trial by jury, and Stephen did not get a trial by jury. Kaplan was the one who you know, found against Donziger. Kaplan was the one who issued all of these civil contempt orders, and ultimately on July 31st of 2019, it was Judge Kaplan who found Stephen Donziger in criminal contempt, which he is allowed to do under the rules, and he went to the United States Attorney. He went to the federal prosecutor. Now, this is the second time we're going to a federal prosecutor, this time under the Trump administration, and said to the federal prosecutor, will you please prosecute Donziger on these criminal charges that I have now brought? And the Trump administration prosecutor said, no, we don't have the resources. Well, anybody who knows the Southern District of New York knows they have all the resources they need for anything that they want to do. That was just an excuse basically saying this is not something we want to get involved in. This is, you know, essentially a corporate prosecution, and that's not what we do here in the Southern District, even under Donald Trump. So then Judge Kaplan went out and appointed special private counsel, which he has a right to do under the rules, almost never done, but technically it exists. He has the right to do that. He appointed Rita Glavin and the Seward and Kissel law firm, which themselves had previously represented Chevron, and which is deeply entwined representing the oil and gas industry. He did not select a rigorously disinterested prosecutor. You know, he selected, you know, a prosecutor who was on Team Big Oil. And then, not content to be the guy that brought the charges, be the guy who was the complaining witness, be the guy who picked the prosecutor, he then circumvented rules of regular random judicial selection and handpicked Judge Preska to be the judge that heard the case. But wait, there's more. Just in case that was not enough, he refused to recuse himself from the case. So he was the complaining witness, the guy that brought the charges, the guy that picked the prosecutor, the guy that picked the judge, and also the judge. Now, no matter how big your head is, you cannot wear all those hats. But he did.
So many moving parts, so much corruption. What will the thrust of your grounds for appeal be?
Well, happily, I'm not doing the appeal. this ended up becoming, you know, a massive pro se undertaking, consuming months and months and months of time. But I can tell you the grounds that I see for appeal, first and foremost, are the ones I just described, that the entire process by which Donziger was criminalized, the judge selected, the judge refusing to recuse himself, you know, were all fundamentally incompatible with each other. You cannot have a type of system where the judge, who is the original aggrieved party, plays all of these different and inherently inconsistent roles. And the second major ground for appeal is that there is a body of law regarding private prosecutors. Now, you know, there's a reason we don't have private prosecutors much in America. And that's because when private parties are invested with state power, number one, they're not accountable to anybody. And number two, they may well have an interest in the outcome independent of simply being prosecutors wanting to see justice done. And so, you know, while fairly common in 18th and 19th century America, we've pretty much done away with private prosecutors except in this one very narrow context. And the Supreme Court has ruled that a private prosecutor, if they're going to be appointed under this special proceeding, they have to be rigorously disinterested in the outcome of the case outside of their prosecutorial function. That is, they don't stand to gain or lose anything. They're not gaining new business as a result of it. This is nothing that they're going to be touting on their website. They don't have a financial interest in the outcome. And that was not the case with the appointment of the Seward and Kissel firm. They were deeply and remain deeply entwined with the oil and gas industry and had previously represented Chevron itself. So I think that the Second Circuit, I'm hopeful that the Second Circuit Court of Appeals is going to find that to be a bridge too far. But as we know, because we know what institutions do, the primary function of the Court of Appeals is to protect the district court judges and to protect judicial appearances, not to protect the individual humans that become victims of this system. So it's a toss-up, really.
We're speaking with attorney Ron Kuby, who's represented Steve Donziger. Ron, what is the level of funding that Chevron has poured into the fighting of Steve and Tellis? I mean, the expenses are about $3 billion ballpark. They've called on 60 law firms and 2,000 lawyers, all to evade pollution liability in Ecuador. What does this level of funding tell us?
It tells us a few things, all of which are extremely, extremely troublesome as lawyers, as people, or as citizens who have some sort of faith in the rule of law, or some sort of hope in the rule of law. Long ago, the Chevron CEO who may have shuffled off this mortal coil said of this litigation, "We will fight them until hell freezes over, then we will fight them on the ice." And what that suggests, and I've seen other corporate polluter litigation proceed along this track, that the corporate polluters, the corporate criminals, will spend any and all funds necessary to make sure that this litigation lasts not just through a lifetime, but through as many lifetimes as necessary. They will never pay in litigation. They will happily spend much more than the judgment to fight the litigation. And as a practical matter, those of us that understand how these cases work know that it says to potential plaintiffs' lawyers, you will never get paid. Your investors, the people who are funding this litigation from the plaintiff's side, will never get paid. No matter what happens, you will never get paid. So you are going to spend your lifetime not getting paid, fighting a case that we will never pay for. And so it tends to discourage lawyers because, you know, lawyers are motivated by ideology, certainly, and Stephen is certainly a committed environmental lawyer, But Stephen indeed was hoping at the end, when he won this case in Ecuador, where Chevron wanted the case, that he would receive a legal fee to compensate him for, you know, a decade of work. So that's one thing Chevron said, one message it sends. You know, the other message it sends is that the usual guardrails that confine civil litigation, right? That is, nobody spends $1,000 on legal fees to collect $250. Basic market principles prohibit that. None of those principles, none of those guardrails apply when you're dealing with a corporation like Chevron, which is really kind of a mini state, or at least a para-state. And they will engage in what I call cartage-style litigation. They won't just win the case. That's not enough. They'll kill everybody in the village. They'll burn the village down. Then they'll plow the ground with salt so nothing ever grows there. And it says to people, you know, we can't do this. We just can't do this. So I don't think the legal system is the best way at this point to redress these kinds of grievances. I think that we need to come up with different parallel systems, you know, some of which frankly involve humans with automatic weapons, to address these kinds of global injustices.
In a nutshell, what does Stephen Donziger symbolize to Chevron and other multinationals?
Stephen Donziger symbolizes the indomitable will of a single human being fighting on behalf of people who cannot fight or speak for themselves, who simply refuses to stay down after he has been hit over and over and over again. And that's terrifying to Chevron, and it's terrifying to the multinationals. I mean, look, we know that multinational corporations in the third world do their work through death squads. They don't do that much in the United States, honestly. Instead, they try to accomplish something akin to that with lawyers and the legal process. And Stephen just won't stay down. He's Banquo's ghost. He is haunting them all of the time.
Do you expect Preska?
I'll sentence Stephen to time behind bars.
Judge Preska has given every indication that she is not just going to sentence Stephen to jail, but she's kind of eager to do it. And we do have a pool as to how much time, but yeah.
This has just been a pleasure to chat with you about this really important case. How can our listeners follow you and learn more and stay abreast of Donziger's tribulations?
Well, Stephen has a million platforms on social media. Just Google him. You can get his tweets. You can get his Facebook, his, you know, everything else. I'm a little harder to follow. You just have to, like, figure it out. I don't need to be followed. I'm afraid of being followed. Usually people who follow me mean me, you know, bad things, so I try to remain unfollowed as much as possible.
Well, it's been a joy to catch up with you, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care. Free Stephen Donziger.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Whistleblowing Australian journalist and the publisher of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, sits in a jail cell in solitary confinement in London's infamous Belmarsh prison. There he awaits the decision of the British High Court as to whether, at the behest of the Trump and now Biden administrations, he will be extradited to the Eastern District of Virginia to stand trial on 17 counts of espionage under the recently resurrected 1917 Espionage Act, which was originally enacted to be used against spies. He will certainly be sentenced to imprisonment for the rest of his life in a supermax security prison where communications with the outside world will be cut off. His case is on appeal to the British High Court. At the recent extradition hearing, British magistrate Vanessa Beritzer ruled in favor of the United States on all of the 17 counts of espionage lodged against him by the Trump administration. She did, however, rule that Julian Assange would be subjected to terrible conditions in an American Maximax security prison and therefore should not be expedited. The Biden administration has appealed this ruling. The charges Assange faces are a major threat to press freedom. Attorney James Goodale, who represented the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case, commented, quote, "The charge against Assange for conspiracy with a source is the most dangerous I can think of with respect to the First Amendment in all my years representing media organizations. It is crucial to build support for Assange and prevent his delivery into the hands of a Biden administration and its prosecutors. Julian Assange's crime was to expose the war crimes, murder, and the inner workings of the American empire to the world press. He might pay for this embarrassment with his life." Today, we talked to John Shipton, Julian's father. He's in America from his native Australia, touring to raise support for his victimized son. John Shipton, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Pleasure.
John, your son, Julian Assange, was a young computer genius. He developed a way to make illegal government action transparent while at the same time protecting the whistleblowers who were the source about these illegal government actions. Please talk to us about what Julian did to bring down on his head the wrath of the powerful American empire.
Well, there are two elements there, Mike. One is the using Tor, which was the Onion router, to provide anonymity to those that would like to leak information or other methods. So whatever it was, the person who provided the insight to the leaks would be protected and remain anonymous. Secondly, and this is a really interesting piece, that if you hold up on the internet the leaks as a library, then in open source method, a wiki can establish itself and all of us can participate in the analysis of that information. Consequently, it improves the public's understanding of policy and also enables the public, or the polity, if you like, to participate more accurately in democracy. Both of those things really important.
What's the legal status of his case now, John?
Julian was won his extradition case against the United States, and the judge ruled that Julian could not be extradited to the United States on account of health reasons, that he would be put in Colorado Supermax under SAM's regulation, special administrative measures, and consequently would be liable to suicide. So that was appealed by the United States. And the Crown Prosecuting Service in the UK said that the appeal, whether the appeal can go ahead, will be heard sometime this week by a single High Court judge. This week, more maybe, you know, you can't rely on these people, but this week, the High Court judge will make a decision as to whether the American appeal against non-extradition can go ahead. The appeal itself would be in autumn, well into autumn, the hearing of the appeal, should the judge give permission.
So in the meantime, Julian is sitting in solitary in Belmarsh Prison and will have to stay there at least until the fall.
Yes, it's very odd that they don't give him permission to bail. I mean, it's very odd that he's in there anyway. But adding to that procedural irregularity, Julian can't go anywhere because in any nation that Julian went to would immediately be faced with an extradition request by the United States. So there's no good reason for Julian to be held away from his family, his new children and his partner. No good reason at all. We think it's malice.
He spent 7 years in two small rooms in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he had been given political asylum by the Ecuadorian government. Then he was forcibly removed to Belmarsh prison. He had no sunlight, could not go out for medical care. How's his health now?
Not the best. The review of Julian's health by the United Nations Rapporteur on Torture, Professor Nils Melzer of Glasgow University, is accurate. And Nils Melzer, Professor Melzer, took along two experts who evaluated Julian's well-being after 11 years of, at that stage 10 years of arbitrary detention, and determined that Julian was suffering the physical and mental effects of torture. The sort of torture was mobbing, calumny, and endless procedural irregularities with no end in sight as to when he was going to be freed or what was going to happen to him, other than another court case following another court case. Each of those cases had procedural irregularities embedded within them. That's deliberate.
Let's talk about what underlied Julian's actions, please, John. What do you know about Julian's beliefs and his values? You raised him. You're his father. How did he grow up to be this extraordinarily admirable person?
Well, this is mostly, entirely, actually, his mother's doing. She, Christine, inculcated into Julian a love of justice and also the strength within the soul to be able to tell the truth. Of course, telling the truth is very hard work, as you know, because it can get you into awful trouble, as demonstrated by Julian's 11-year circumstance. But anyway, that's his nature, to speak truthfully and to hunger for justice and to use all of the strength in his arm to ensure that those who suffer injustice are given relief.
Tell us about his companion, Stella Morris. She's the mother of their two small children. And also tell us about his half-brother, your son, Gabriel Shipton.
Well, Stella, a lovely woman. She's a trained lawyer. She's born, her father's Cuban, and her mum is Catalan from Barcelona. She speaks Swedish and Spanish and English. Her studies were in law at Oxford University. So she's bright, devoted, and has a very, very close family. So she doesn't have to, in her travels and fighting for her lover, she doesn't have to worry about having people to look after the children or the home falling into disrepair as her family gather around her and her sister. That has circumstances has given immense strength to Stella and consequently to Julian. Gabriel is 39 now. He's a film producer. This is normally what they call feature-length films, fictional films, but this time is embarked upon a documentary which of my and Stella's actions in order to get Julian freed. So it's interesting in as much as that it's in the United States, all of Europe, Australia and the UK, these two, Stella and myself, followed by cameramen, fighting in every way we can to get the news out and to thank people for their support. Yeah, it's been very rewarding to work so closely with Gabrielle.
John, what kind of support has been shown to you and your family and to Julian so far on your tour here in the United States?
Oh, excellent. You know, we just had, we stayed in the Haitian Quarter in Miami, and we were housed by Medea Benjamin, the convener of Code Pink. And oddly enough, we formed a bridge. So we had tremendous reception at the Bitcoin conference, who are mostly libertarians. Code Pink are pacifists or anti-war, really, not pacifists. And they slightly to the left of center. So we formed a bridge between those two disparate groups. So that was great in Miami. In Boston, we're at the Boston Common, 1634, a historical place to have a meeting in. And we have Richard Stallman, probably one of the brightest men in America, and Jill Stein, numerous others, supporting us. And off we go in a minute to a church down the road where Julian will be given the Zacco and Vanzetti Prize for social contribution. Last year, the person who received it was Daniel Ellsberg. So, you know, very proud pantheon of defenders of the fundamental values of the United States.
What kind of international support is Julian getting?
Now, this is the good bit. Worldwide, as it's a global problem, we started work in Europe. And as it's a global problem, in particular, the focus of Europe is that they see it as their problem because WikiLeaks was first registered in France, although the website itself is registered in California. But the first court case for publishing was fought in France. The publications were Le Monde, Der Spiegel, Guardian. All of the employees were Europeans and English people, United Kingdom people. So they saw it as persecution of Julian and WikiLeaks with the publications. They saw it as a European problem, which of course it is. So the Council of Europe made a strong statement in defense of Julian. Every single journalist association in the Western world have made statements of support. 24 of the world's largest NGOs put a letter into the New York Times. The German Parliament has a cross-party group. The French Parliament has a cross-party group. The Spanish Parliament has a cross-party group. Just this morning, the United Kingdom Parliament had a cross-party group, and they had a meeting which we were invited to and attended. In Australia, there's 212 parliamentarians in total, 26 of those supporters, the opposition party, which is the equivalent of the Democrats in Australia, made a declaration of support. The leader of the opposition made a declaration of support. All of the Greens are supporters. So the vigor from the polity, encouraging politicians in a classic working of democracy, that vigor has sort of an upwelling or inflowing tide of support, which of course has kept us going because, you know, we can't go on without their support. You know, I'm a retired man, a pensioner, so we depend upon contributions from people which have been forthcoming to make these trips and these actions possible. So worldwide, the global problem is receiving global support. The first person to realize that it was a global problem was James Goodall, who was the lawyer for the New York Times when Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers. So significant in every direction.
How can people contribute to your effort and show their support? Do you have a website?
Yes, we do have a website, AssangeCampaign.com. Sorry, I just ask Gabrielle, homerunforjulian.com. Sorry, there's so many of them that I tend to forget them, but this one is homerunforjulian.com.
I'm going to ask you that again at the end of our interview, John, but I wanted people to get ready and have a pen if they need it. John Chipton, if the Biden administration prevails and Julian loses his appeal and he's sent back to the Eastern District of Virginia for trial, where he most certainly will be found guilty, what does this mean to the freedom of press and for our right to hear? Isn't this really a fundamental question of democracy?
Indeed it is, and it goes, geez, this is a deep, you know, this is a real rabbit hole that, you know, have a look down this hole. In the first place, Julian has about 100 lawyers in jurisdictions in seven countries. The cost is millions of dollars. And Julian is being pursued as an individual, okay? Not WikiLeaks, but as an individual. The consequence of this is that every journalist in the world who picks up a pencil or opens their keyboard will face the wrath of the Department of Justice if they write anything that's critical of the United States or even the United States, sorry, I'll change that, critical of Washington or critical of what Washington does or analyzes policy to illuminate what Washington wants to do or is doing, will face the wrath of the Department of Justice. Very few individual journalists, and I stress this, that the attack is against an individual doing. Very few can have 100,000 people assisting worldwide and raise money and also get the assistance of many, many lawyers who work pro bono or for very little money because of the depth of understanding that this is a global problem with the repression of comment, the intimidation of journalists, and the ruination of democracy. The great beauty of democracy is that knowledge brings freedom. So this is, I think, Prometheus Unbound from the poet Shelley. Knowledge will bring freedom. And bringing that knowledge is, of course, the great calling of journalists, to bring knowledge to us so that we can discuss amongst ourselves and formulate opinions and understandings of government action or what we would like government to do or not do. Also, this brings benefit to the polity and brings benefit to government, because it has at its core an educated populace. And with an educated populace, that means a higher quality of parliamentarian, or I think in the United States we call them congressmen. So, and also a more educated and aware institutions of state. That this is so important. That I remember back in the 60s and 70s the tremendous intellectual ferment emitting from mostly California into the world that shaped the modern world. Or in a sense, we are all Californians. You know, we dress casually most of the time. We are concerned with cuisine. We like to have variety in our cuisine and variety in our visual field. Many things like that, emitting or a sort of understanding of the body, understanding of the physics of the world, you know, that Fritjof Capra's book or Alan Watts's book or Gregory Bateson's book, many profound understandings moving into the world live in a lively fashion, because the United States in its wisdom allowed freedom of the press. That beautiful thing is now at risk. I don't know why they have decided to place it at risk in Washington, but it's a disaster. Outside of the United States, what we envy of the United States and agitate in our own countries for is a First Amendment, free speech, and a Bill of Rights. These are great civilizational artifacts of the United States that we outside the United States wish that we had for ourselves.
John Shipton, the last time you visited your son, Julian, in prison, what were the conditions like? And what was it like? What did you speak to him about? And how was he doing?
Oh, it's a little shop of horrors, the jail. And, you know, they've got... You go through four portals, you're searched and x-rayed again. And then a dog sniff comes up. You go into a room with the other poor buggers. Julian, you know, you embrace and sit down, but you're overheard, and there's cameras in the high fidelity, actually, cameras in the ceiling, so they can lip read if you try and whisper. So those are circumstances. I last visited in March last year. Julian hasn't had a visitor, legal or otherwise, since October last year. We have that circumstances. I mean, there's a COVID infestation in the jail amongst the staff and the prisoners. So we hope that circumstances will be resolved very soon. That's the circumstance of Julian's incarceration. Not good.
John, can you repeat again the website so that our listeners can support Julian Assange?
Yes, thank you, Mike. I hope I haven't tested your patience here. The website that we are running for this tour of the United States is homerun4julian.com.
I wanted to ask you if you had any final thoughts for our audience.
Yeah, this, you know, it's a symbol, or iconographic symbol of an attitude to our ability to ordinarily have illuminated and erudite discussions with each other based upon the information we can get at. The oppression of this is very worrying for our future and our, well, for the present. We want to know what's going on. And Washington, in its wisdom, has decided that we can't. We must fight with all our strength. strength to ensure that we can again participate in our own communities, and the communities themselves can generate creatively understandings, like, for example, the latest one is distributed systems, and find how a distributed system works and what the benefits it will bring us. Very important.
John Shipton, we so admire you, and we here at Law and Disorder are in total support of you and your family and of Julian Assange. The founder of our show was Michael Ratner, as you know. He was Julian's first attorney here in the USA, and we're continuing in Michael's tradition in showing our support for Julian, and we'll continue to report on his situation and continue to support him till we get him out of there. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Godspeed, Mike and Jeff.
Thanks. You take it easy, John. So long.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.